Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support the Peter B. Collins Show, and I'm grateful to Linda Gray of Woodinville, Washington, and Gail, with no last name, in Lakewood, a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. Thank you for your support of our new podcast series. You can help, too. Just log on to peterbcollins.com. In this edition of the program, in a few minutes, we'll be joined by Colonel Ann Wright. She's a founding member of Code Pink. She served in the military and the State Department and is now focused on fighting back against sexual assault in the military. And there's a new website for female soldiers that we'll draw your attention to in just a few minutes. Also on today's program, Andy Drawl, a longtime listener. He's a Wall Street analyst, and he's got some ideas about reforming corporate governance based on our recent conversation about corporate personhood and the case before the Supreme Court. Our music of the moment is from Michael Franti and Spearhead. There's a line in there about, don't bother about the torture. Well, some of us do bother about America's torture policies, and we're not going to let Dick Cheney try to scare us into some sort of subservience, and we're not going to allow those who were complicit or those who now try to rationalize the wrongdoing that occurred under Bush, Cheney, and the gang, and somehow say that it made us safer and somehow say that it was okay. David Cole is a professor of law at Georgetown University. He's also a legal affairs correspondent for one of my favorite publications, The Nation magazine. He writes for the New York Review of Books, and he won the American Book Award for his book, Enemy Aliens. Professor Cole, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And I have in my hands your newest book. It's a paperback edition of the Torture Memos, subtitled Rationalizing the Unthinkable. And first, I thank you for your commitment to our Constitution and to the rule of law and for the commentary that you provided in these deeply troubling memos. And I think people should take the time to read them so they understand what was done in our names.
Thank you. Well, yeah, that was the idea in publishing the book, was that what we need here is for people to really see what the nation's top lawyers in the government under President Bush, what they said to reach the, and how they thought in terms of reaching the conclusion that it's not torture and not even cruel, inhuman, or degrading to slam someone against the wall repeatedly, yeah, slap him, force him to be naked, pour water over him, and waterboard him hundreds of times.
And the tortured language, the tortured logic, the torture of the law is something that is just, it's so overwhelming as you read these memos. Yet Dick Cheney continues to make these appearances on the Fox News Channel, calmly defending this, trying to minimize it. Oh, only three people were waterboarded. And I don't believe the minimization that they're offering us. There's just too much conflicting, totally contradicting evidence that is out there in the public domain. But it does appear that there are many people who are persuaded by this, and some of them are not Neanderthal Republicans.
Well, I think if you look at polling data on torture, people, the country's fairly divided, and there are a substantial number of people who think it's legitimate to torture terrorism suspects in various circumstances. The answer to that question for a lot of people, I think, depends upon the circumstances, of course, and the most, the sort of typical example given is where there's a ticking time bomb, it's about to go off, you've got the person who said it, he's not telling you where it is, you don't have time to get the information in any other way. In that setting, is it legitimate to use physical force to compel him to talk when he's not otherwise going to talk?
But that Jack Bauer scenario is bullshit.
Exactly. I mean, it never arises. And one of the most interesting things that, I've argued for years, that it's an imaginary hypothetical. You're never in a position where you know, any of the key facts, namely that this is the person who set the bomb, that it's going to go off in X amount of time, that there's no other way to get the information, that if you torture him, he will tell you that information. It just doesn't. Real life doesn't happen that way. Real life happens where so much is unknown. And one of the things that we saw on August 24th, when the CIA Inspector General report was issued, this is a report that the Inspector General of the CIA wrote in 2004, but was only just issued on August 24th, 2009. One of the things that the CIA Inspector General said was that there's no evidence that a single imminent terrorist attack was thwarted by this entire program.
And somehow Dick Cheney's not aware of that. He's still lying like a sack of something. I mean, it's just amazing to see him twist all this and try to create an alternate reality.
Well, I think, two things are going on here, at least. One is, if there were a honest-to-God criminal investigation, he'd be suspect number one, because he has admitted that he authorized these tactics, including waterboarding, tactics that President Obama and Attorney General Holder have said point-blank are torture. And under our law, torture is a crime. So he's defending himself as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. But secondly, I think he's playing to American fears and sort of trying to set himself and the Republican Party up as the party that we can trust when we are in need. And in the event that there is another terrorist attack, he'll be in a position to say, "See, I told you so." Mm-hmm. We used these harsh measures, and there were no terrorist attacks in the 7 years after 9/11 that we, at least in the United States, that we were in power. Barack Obama comes in, and if there is another terrorist attack, you can be sure that he'll blame it on the fact that the president has decided in a variety of ways to adhere to the law rather than to just thrust the law aside.
But, and that's a demonstration of just how sinister he is, because he never acknowledges that we were hit on his watch and that they fumbled, they failed, and they want to blame intelligence gathering for Iraq. But the information was right there in front of their eyes. Al-Qaeda prepared to attack the United States, the August 6th presidential daily brief. And all of that is just elided, ignored, so that Cheney can talk about how he kept America safe. And this is what so many people are swallowing. And it infuriates me, Professor, because I do think that the way Obama is handling this is feeding the whole Cheney mindset, and it is working to their advantage. And if the president had not adopted this ridiculous notion of looking forward and not backward and simply allowed the process to run its course, we would have Dick Cheney silenced right now, because he'd be spending all of his time with his defense attorneys figuring out how to protect himself from potentially serious prosecution.
Well, that's certainly possible. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to say, to sort of push for accountability for the past, that it's not enough to look forward. You need to, where there's been serious wrongs done in the past, you need, the rule of law needs to have some measure of accountability. And you know, one measure, one form of accountability is public debate and history and the like. And so the idea was to put out these memos, let people see what they say, offer a commentary that that makes the case, that really sort of for the first time analyzes the full range of legal arguments that the Bush lawyers made and shows point by point why they were wrong, why they were contorting the law to authorize precisely what it forbade, and why they are, in some ways, the most culpable actors here. They had a responsibility to say no when asked whether the CIA could use these tactics legally, and instead of abiding by their responsibility and saying no, they said yes at every juncture. And what's worse, they said yes. What the memos show is that even as it appeared in public that the law was tightening up to underscore that that these tactics could not be used, the Bush lawyers were writing secret memos assuring the CIA that despite the fact that the law now said you couldn't use cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment against anyone anywhere, and previously they had said that protection didn't apply to people in CIA holding centers, despite the fact that now the law says you can't impose cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment on anyone, we'll look at these tactics and we'll conclude, we'll tell you that in fact you don't need to change any of them because none of them are cruel, degrading, or inhuman, a much, much lower standard than torture. So even as the law in public appeared to be tightening its grip and reasserting the ban on torture and cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, the Bush lawyers were in secret writing memos that defined away those very prohibitions for the purpose of allowing the CIA to continue to impose brutal tactics on its detainees.
We're talking with Professor David Cole from Georgetown. His new book, The Torture Memos, is out. And it includes a foreword from Philippe Sands. He is a British journalist and attorney who I have great respect for. His book, The Torture Team, identified the origin of the policies. And it was one of those deniability games where Rumsfeld said, I want you to rough these people up, so send me a memo asking if you can use aggressive techniques. And that came up from Diane Beaver at Guantanamo and some of the others. Jeffrey Miller was the second commander there, and he is the guy who really put these policies into action. And, Professor, the book is detailed. The memos are in some ways a little repetitive. But what they do is detail the extent to which the administration went to first redefine terms that were very clear to begin with and remain very clear in the English language, and then to try to redefine the law to permit the result that they were looking for. And I wanted to focus on one of the Bybee memos that was written for Gonzalez. This is August 1st, 2002, where the man who now has a lifetime appointment to my appeals court here, the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, creates a phony self-defense argument. And I'd like you to explain this to our listeners a little bit, because certainly, you know, when people get into an altercation, if there's a burglar at your home, everybody understands what we consider to be a legal right to self-defense. But this took that and went beyond, you know, putting it on its ear. It propelled it into a whole new orbit. Could you explain, please?
Well, that's right. I mean, the memo argued, made many, many arguments for why CIA interrogators could use torturous tactics without being criminally responsible under a statute that absolutely forbids torture. But one of them was precisely the self-defense defense. And whereas, as you're absolutely right, it ordinarily applies where an individual is being attacked by someone who threatens his life and limb, he is permitted to use violence in self-defense where it is. He shows that it is necessary or reasonable to believe that it was necessary to do so to protect himself. But what the what this memo says is that a CIA interrogator can claim self-defense, not on the theory that the detainee who is shackled and stripped naked and blindfolded, et cetera, poses any threat to the to the interrogator, but that he's acting in self-defense of the nation.
Yeah.
As a whole, the concept of the nation. And he doesn't have to show that the detainee, who again is in shackles, blindfolded, naked, in a some secret prison thousands of miles from the U.S., he doesn't have to show that he's likely to succeed in his attack in any imminent way, which, of course, under ordinary self-defense theory, you do have to show that it's imminent. Because the potential harm that Al Qaeda might do is so great that we can sort of throw the imminence requirement out the window. And you know what's? I mean, these are really wild interpretations of the self-defense concept.
Well, they're ridiculous.
What's most striking, though, of course, is that the Justice Department is generally not in the business of coming up with wildly liberal interpretations of defense theories.
Yeah.
They are in the business of prosecuting, and so their interest is in interpreting these things very narrowly. But in this one instance, where sort of their self-interest lay on the other side, they were willing to come up with arguments that I don't think any criminal defense attorney would even have the temerity to advance.
Now, here's another Bybee memo that I'd like to go into a little bit of depth on. And I want to just read through this one list, because what this memo does is it's to the attention of the general counsel at the Central Intelligence Agency, dated August 1st of 2002. And it provides a list of these techniques and then goes on to try to find fantastical ways to explain that they don't amount to torture. The 10 techniques are, when you read this laundry list and you see these people, in this sanitized legal ease, trying to explain away what are very violent, physical actions taken against an individual who cannot defend himself. The 10 techniques that are covered in this memo are called attention grasp, walling, facial hold, facial slap, cramped confinement, wall standing, stress positions, sleep deprivation, insects placed in a confinement box, and the waterboard. Now, some of these you think might surface from a Hollywood screenwriter, the guy who's working as a waiter at Spago and hoping that Spielberg will take his script. But it's sad and tragic to see, our officials trying to defend the indefensible. Let me just pick a couple of these out. Can you describe walling, and how on earth this could ever be constructed as something that is not cruel, inhumane, and mounting to torture?
Well, walling consists of taking a human being, grabbing him, and slamming him into a wall as many times as the interrogator thinks is necessary in order to shock the individual and encourage him to agree to talk. They did it against a kind of a fake wall, and the theory was that if you do it against a fake wall, it's less likely to do permanent damage. But what the Justice Department lawyers said was, well, we recognize that it might hurt to be slammed into a wall, but the CIA tells us that it doesn't hurt very much, and therefore it's not severe pain, and we've interpreted the torture statute to only prohibit the infliction of severe pain, which we have in turn defined as pain rising to the level of that associated with death or organ failure. So yes, it might hurt to get thrown against the wall, but it doesn't hurt as bad as death or organ failure, and therefore it doesn't constitute torture. And when they get to the question of whether it constitutes cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which is a lower threshold, mm-hmm. doesn't require severe pain, there they basically say, well, the real question is whether it shocks the conscience, which is a constitutional standard that sort of got incorporated by the Senate when they adopted this cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment treaty. And it doesn't shock the conscience to slam a person repeatedly into a wall, because the end here is really a really good one, that is trying to find out information that can save American lives. And because, the wall's a sort of a fake wall, it's a wall in front of a wall, and so they've used measures to make sure that it's not a real wall. And they'll have a doctor on hand to ensure that if the pain arises to the level of severe pain associated with organ failure or death, the doctor will stop the exercise from going forward. But of course, how can anybody make an assessment on the spot as to whether an individual is suffering moderate pain or severe pain? I mean, there's no objective way to draw that line. So that's essentially the reasoning they use. They first define the terms extremely narrowly, and then they conclude because the CIA says it doesn't hurt, and because doctors will be present to ensure that it doesn't hurt, it can't possibly inflict the kind of pain that is prohibited under our law.
Bybee continues here, writing about waterboarding. He said, with respect to the waterboard, you have orally informed us that the Navy continues to use it in training. You have informed us that your on-site psychologist have not encountered any significant long-term mental health consequences from its use. Your on-site psychologists have also indicated that JPRA has likewise not reported any significant long-term mental health consequences from the use of the waterboard. Now, this, again, is just a total crock, because waterboarding, or, you know, this simulated drowning, has been used as a torture technique for many centuries. And for them to try to claim that they found some shrinks, psychologists, I don't want to insult real psychiatrists, and we know that the two leaders of the torture program were psychologists who had no background in interrogation, who had no knowledge of Arabic or Muslim culture, and who were just a couple of opportunists who were able to cash in on the fear-mongering that came after 9/11. And so this is a kind of rationalization that is shocking on the face of it. It simply cannot be justified or validated. It's just words on a page.
Well, and one of the most remarkable things about this part of the argument, and you see this argument not only in the 2002 memo that you're quoting from, but also in 2005, much later, much further away from the attacks of 9/11, after we had evidence of how abusive the CIA was acting because of the Inspector General's report, which within the government was released in 2004, they're still making this argument. The argument is basically, since we do some of these tactics, including waterboarding, to our soldiers in training, therefore it can't be torture. Therefore it can't be illegal. But of course, the difference between a situation in which you are in a mock training exercise, your friends are imposing these tactics, you know it's fake, you're given a code word that allows you to stop it whenever you choose to stop it. The difference between that and being subjected to these tactics in an entirely hostile environment by your enemy, where you're cut off from the entire outside world, and you have no idea how far they will go if you don't talk or give in to their will, is totally different. It's like saying because consensual sex doesn't impose severe pain and suffering, rape doesn't either.
That's an excellent analogy. And, Professor, the same Bybee memo goes into some, I would almost call it, excruciating detail about Abu Zubaydah. And essentially, Bybee tries and convicts him in this memo and rationalizes that any treatment of this animal, I'm inserting that word, he doesn't use it, is justifiable. And, you know, we saw that where Jose Padilla was convicted by John Ashcroft in a news conference shortly after he was taken into custody. And we have this very broad-based assertion that only really, really, really bad people were sent to Guantanamo. But Andy Worthington, another great British journalist, has detailed every single case of the people who went to Guantanamo, and easily two-thirds of those people were completely innocent of anything related to terrorism or any significant threat to the United States. And yet we have Americans who believe that anybody who ever went to Guantanamo was, one of the darkest people on earth. And when we saw the Uyghurs, who were completely innocent, sold into bounty and should have been released years ago, a couple of them went to Bermuda And here at a little cocktail party in San Francisco, there was somebody who started joking about that, saying, well, I wish I could get a free trip to Bermuda. And I said, do you really want to pay the price that they paid? But we have this generalized notion that if they were picked up by our government, including the CIA, during this dark period, that they were just de facto guilty, and any kind of treatment that we wanted to administer to them is justifiable.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, much of what is really going on here is the combination of two arguments. One, the end justifies the means. And again, you see this throughout the memos. The notion is, well, you know, this might not be permissible if we were just investigating a robbery or if we were even investigating a murder in the U.S., but because it's terrorism and because it could be catastrophic, the usual rules don't apply. And two, these people are deadly dangerous, and they're foreigners. And so we can do things to them that we would never be permitted to do to U.S. citizens. It's sort of that double standard, which, again, you see used again and again here to justify treating people as less than human. And, you know, I think that what this teaches us, if it teaches us anything, is that while we rely on law to constrain government officials from abusing their powers, unless we have good people in the positions that are supposed to be enforcing the law, that law is not going to be much of a safeguard, because in the hands of a clever lawyer, they can read, you know, black to mean white and white to mean black, and authorize whatever the government seeks to do, and that's what you saw here. Time and time again, and my own view is that the lawyer, that in some fundamental way, these memos are the smoking gun in this whole controversy, because they lay out in cold clinical detail the crimes that were committed and were committed at the highest levels of the prior administration. And it's not until we have some official acknowledgement of that wrongdoing, whether it's through a criminal prosecution or through a independent commission or through a disbarment proceedings or civil damages actions, you know, through a congressional resolution, through some official mechanism, until we have an acknowledgement that was not just a bad policy but wrong, I don't think we will have come out of this really dark period in our history.
And Professor, I just want to put some faces on this, because the Principals Committee of the National Security Council sat at times receiving emails, text messages, and phone calls from the people who were conducting these interrogations that used these techniques that you and I consider to be torture. And we have Condoleezza Rice. We have Colin Powell, who has been trying to separate himself from the worst of the worst of the Bush era. But he was in those meetings. David Addington, Cheney's chief of staff, and prior to that, when Libby was there, he was counsel to the vice president. Cheney himself, Rumsfeld, and there are probably a handful of others. But I see this rope-a-dope effort here, where Eric Holder is saying that he's going to go for people who went beyond these torture memos. And certainly, those people deserve to be investigated and prosecuted as needed. But to imagine that it would be considered a political witch hunt to hold accountable those who framed and defined and implemented these policies is just, it really offends me in the deepest way, because these are the same kinds of people who cannot rationalize any kind of criminal behavior when they see it on TV. But when it comes to the highest level of our government and the people who take an oath to defend and protect the Constitution, not the country, then we've got a very serious problem here, and the Obama administration seems intent on burying these misdeeds as much as they can.
Well, you know, I think we certainly have a serious problem. I hope the Obama administration isn't intent on burying them. I mean, I do think you have to give them some credit for fighting to disclose these memos. I mean, until Obama came to power, these memos were secret. Mm-hmm. They've only now been disclosed. The same thing is true with the CIA Inspector General report. I do think that they haven't gone far enough in terms of being willing to sort of put accountability at the right level, namely the lawyers and the cabinet level officials who authorized these programs in the first place, not just a few line interrogators who may have gone even beyond what the brutality that the Justice Department authorized. But so I think it's our sort of, you know, our duty as citizens to really push for more accountability. Because, as I said, at the end of the day, if you've got a situation where we don't practice torture when we have presidents who don't believe in torture, but we practice torture when we have presidents who do believe in torture, then there's no real legal prohibition on the tactic.
And, Professor, do you support the calls from some quarters for an impeachment proceeding against Judge Bybee and for disbarment proceedings against John Yoo?
What I support is accountability, broadly conceived, and it may be the case that that accountability should take the form of disbarment proceedings, impeachment proceedings, and the like. I think at this point, the most, in some senses, the most important thing is that the facts be laid out. I've sought to lay out the facts through these torture memos, but there are still substantial facts that remain not disclosed. The Office of Professional Responsibility in the Justice Department, which is the ethics office there, has reportedly investigated Judge Bybee and investigated Professor Yoo and their role in the preparation of the initial memos. And again, reportedly, we haven't seen the report, but it exists, but it just hasn't been released to the public yet. Reportedly, they recommend that that John Yoo and Jay Bybee be referred to their bars for disciplinary action. So they've had access to the emails, the faxes, notes, et cetera, that may reflect even more negatively on the roles that these lawyers played. Namely, they may show that they really had a predetermined, I mean, I think the memos on their face show that they had a predetermined result and sought to contort the law to that end, but the, you know, internal communications may reinforce that. And it's pretty serious for the Ethics Office of the Justice Department to refer such high-level officials for disciplinary action, and that suggests that there is some more damning evidence out there. My position is you got to get that evidence out. We've got to have it all out on the table. None of it should be secret anymore. And then we can make a judgment about what the appropriate form of accountability is. It may be a criminal prosecution for some of these people. It may be disbarment for others. It may be impeachment for others. But what's critical is that there be official accountability.
Well, and you and I are generous enough to say that we want to give these individuals due process.
Which
they were not willing to offer to the subjects of their memoranda.
Well, that's right. And part of that due process, of course, is giving them an ability, you know, an opportunity to defend themselves.
Sure, I'd love to hear it.
In a proceeding, yeah. but we're not going to get there unless there is an investigation that goes beyond the one that's so far been authorized, namely of the few CIA interrogators and contractors who went beyond the authorized brutality.
Professor Cole, anything you'd like to add in closing here?
I think that's it. I think we've covered the waterfront very well, so thank you so much for the interview.
Well, it's my pleasure. I want to recommend the book, The Torture Memos, subtitled Rationalizing the Unthinkable. It's out at an affordable price from the New Press, and I encourage you to take a look. Professor David Cole, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, and we're sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. We get a small commission if you buy their wines. And now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. There's a special introductory offer for PBC listeners. And be sure to check out the Prosecco. Chill it and drink it on a hot afternoon. You'll enjoy it. And you can just log on to ecowine.com to get full information if that's easier for you. Still to come on the PBC show, Andy Drawl. He's a listener and he's also an analyst on Wall Street. He's got some ideas about how to improve corporate governance. We'll tell you about that in just a few minutes. Returning to our program today is Colonel Ann Wright. She served in the United States Army, and then she served our United States State Department, the Foreign Service, and she was assigned to countries like Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Grenada, Nicaragua, Uzbekistan, Micronesia, and Mongolia. And to her credit, Colonel Wright resigned her position and submitted that to the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, at the time, in protest over our invasion of Iraq. Since then, she has worked tirelessly as an international peacemaker, trying to bring peace to the United States through her work with Code Pink and other activist groups. And later in our conversation, we'll talk about her recent efforts to bring some peace to the occupied territory of Gaza. Ann Wright, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I have great respect for you, Ann, and I just appreciate that you have not gone into retirement. You probably deserve it. And every time I talk to you, I recall that you do have a home in Hawaii, but almost every time we chat, you're not there. So
That's right.
I thank you for all the hours, the days, and some of the arrests that you have put in, speaking for me and others who really want to bring a whole new approach to foreign policy to the United States government.
Well, thank you so much. It's, you know, I feel it's a responsibility having been in the government for so long and then leaving the government on points of principle and using the background that I had from my years in the military and in the diplomatic corps to speak about the issues and the concerns that I have about first the Bush administration's foreign policies and now under the Obama administration, many difficulties I have with the way the Obama administration is pursuing some aspects of foreign policy.
Well, now, how can you say that? All our troops are home from Iraq.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, the continuing on of the Bush administration timetable for removal of troops, which we never agreed with the Bush administration, so I don't know why we should agree with it under the Obama administration. And now with, she'll say, I have 50,000 troops there for years and years and years. And I don't agree with that at all, so I continue to speak out on it.
And
what's going on in Afghanistan.
Well, I want to talk about both of those, but Colonel, could I ask you and your Code Pink allies to make George Will an honorary member? I can't recall when I agreed with George Will on something, but in two columns this past week before Labor Day, he has called for an end to our involvement in Afghanistan, and he correctly assessed the situation there. And I was stunned by a column here at the end of the week where he's saying it's time for us to get out of Iraq. And gosh, I mean, if George Will has reached that point, how on earth can we continue with a Republican Secretary of Defense and continue with essentially the same track that was in place when Bush left office?
That's exactly right. And trying to explain exactly those things to the American public, and particularly those people who worked so hard that Obama elected as president. And I think many of them are shell-shocked, really, at what has happened since the inauguration of President Obama, that so many of the, well, several of the Bush administration people kept on, both on the defense side and on the economic policy side, and then bringing in essentially the old Clinton crew for foreign policies. And a lot of people had a lot of disputes with the way things were handled then. So I think a lot of people are becoming a little bit discouraged with the new administration on the issues of foreign policy. I mean, I certainly want to give him credit on some of the policies that he's going after, of trying to roll back the things that happened on the environment under the Bush administration, trying to stop the cutting of forests, trying to regulate the amount of oil leases that are going on. Saying that we will participate in Copenhagen at the international, the UN climate conference, and also saying we'll participate in the non-proliferation treaty conference in New York in May, and saying that we do need to disarm more nuclear weapons. He doesn't say we need to abolish all of them yet, but there are major steps, improvements there.
Mm-hmm.
But this issue of our national security, where we now have the largest defense budget in the history of the world, larger than George Bush's, and such an increase in the military operations in Afghanistan with the increases in numbers of people, 20,000 with probably going up to 60,000 at some stage. So it's very discouraging on some of these levels.
And Anne, I have been recently talking about a mythical substance called Leflon. You'll recall that we were told that Ronald Reagan was our Teflon president, just nothing stuck to him. And it appears that Obama has a new and improved version called Leflon, and that is that he can just flick off the concerns of the left, whether it's for single-payer health care, a rational withdrawal policy from Iraq, a rational debate over our policy in Afghanistan. There's been no debate. There's been no discussion. Simply, he went forward with a campaign promise to put more troops there, and we're seeing now a McChrystal report. But again, there's no open debate in this country, and the left is either asleep or somehow silenced on the very issues that propelled Obama to the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think the left is silent on them. There are a lot of people that are talking about them, but it doesn't seem like any of the discussion from the left is being heard by the White House yet. And I think we've got to definitely ramp it up a lot. We've got to hit back the streets. You know, we've got to have demonstrations in front of the White House. In fact, there will be one on October 5th on mm-hmm. the date that the U.S. first sent in, I believe it was CIA forces into Afghanistan. There's going to be a demonstration in Washington then on October 17th, another date of one of the anniversaries of somebody else going in of U.S. forces into Afghanistan. There are going to be local vigils and marches on that date to say that we are not happy at all with what's going on in Afghanistan. But certainly there's been a lot of air sucked out of the peace movement, the Stop the War movements, by the numbers of people who rightfully, you know, worked for a candidate that they were believing and hoping would bring peace and not more war, and we're seeing things going in a direction that we don't really like. So it's time to ramp it up. We've got the same complaints that we had against George Bush. We've got to be with the Obama administration. So let's get back out there and try to get him doing the things we want him to do.
Now, Anne, you were deputy chief of mission at our embassy in Afghanistan at the time that Bush committed U.S. forces there in late 2001. And I'd like to know your thoughts about, is there any hope whatsoever that we can prop up the Karzai government and that it could develop a police force and a military force that could combat both the warlords and the various elements that we group together and call the Taliban in our media? And is there any possible hope for some kind of a positive outcome from our involvement in Afghanistan?
Well, I was there in late December of 2001 when I was part of the small team that reopened the U.S. embassy that had been closed for 12 years. We reopened it, and we, at that stage, who were on the ground in Afghanistan were saying, you know, there's a very limited window of opportunity that we have here, that the history of Afghanistan is that anyone who comes in for whatever reason leaves eventually, and usually with their tail between their legs. So we've got a short window of opportunity to try to go after al-Qaeda. The issue of the Taliban in governance, that was not helpful for Afghanistan. And I know there are plenty of people that now I'm working with a lot who say, you know, we went about it the wrong way. Invading Afghanistan was not the way to do it if you want to go after al-Qaeda. And indeed, if you look at the successes that we've had against people who have done these criminal acts against the United States, whether it's the bombing of the U.S. embassies in East Africa or the bombing of USS Cole or the bombing of the Khobar Towers, those people have been caught not through U.S. military operations but through extensive international law enforcement methods. And so the argument is, well, maybe that's what we should have used against Al Qaeda. The Taliban, I don't agree with their governance. I don't agree with their treatment of women and children and men, chopping off hands and arms and all that sort of stuff. But what we've now got ourselves into is being there, and now after 8 years, that the Obama administration says, well, now after the diversion to Iraq, we will put in lots of troops into Afghanistan. And now you have the Taliban that's regrouped, recruited, retrained, re-equipped, and coming back in large numbers and mounting major military operations against a huge coalition military force. The issue of how, you know, what can an Afghan national army, what can an Afghan national police do, is a very good one, and that's where the Obama administration is kind of placing all of its efforts following on the same thing that the Bush administration did. But when you really look at it, it's one of the predicaments is that each of the warlords, many of whom we had hired to help us go after Al-Qaeda
yes.
in 2001 and 2002, they're the ones that have contributed part of their militia forces into these Afghan national armies and police. So you have we're training and equipping in great measure people who already have a lot of experience with weapons and who can be recalled at any moment by their warlords. And
right.
we've seen that happen in the last couple of years, that all of a sudden the Afghan National Army just disappears because they don't want to get involved in this fight between U.S. or coalition forces and other Taliban forces.
And so, you know, McChrystal has laid the groundwork. They haven't made an explicit request, but Gates is saying he is certainly open to committing more American troops there. There isn't a clear mission. There certainly isn't an exit strategy. And I'm much more concerned about Turkey and Pakistan, that, you know, in terms of U.S. Direct interests, than I ever have been about Afghanistan. And it's fascinating to me that in McChrystal's report, I didn't hear anything about Al-Qaeda whatsoever. It was all about trying to confront the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite amazing how the rationale has drifted on why the U.S. continues to stay in Afghanistan. And I think you're rightfully pointing out that the real issues I think we have as far as security certainly don't emanate from Afghanistan, but from Pakistan and the Pakistani Taliban that are there, that are making a major challenge toward the government of Pakistan. The Pakistan government that controls, I think it's over 100 nuclear weapons, the government who has now given his freedom back to the Pakistani guy who developed their nuclear weapons and then
AQ Khan.
Move mm-hmm. Nuclear technology to both Libya and to North Korea. And that's a place where strengthening civil society in terms of better education for a huge number of Pakistanis who right now are being ignored by the Pakistani government, I think that's really a major source where we should be concerned on regional security. While as much as I would hope for the best for the women and children of Afghanistan, the future doesn't look rosy for them, in my opinion, because I don't think that the military operations that the U.S. and the coalition, NATO coalition forces are mounting are what ultimately will determine what happens in Afghanistan. Ultimately, it's got to be a political solution. And the longer you keep having these military operations against Taliban forces, then the least likely, in my opinion, it is that you or the Karzai government or whichever government now comes forward after this last election. I mean, even Karzai was having discussions with some of the more moderate elements of the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I think that is what is going to happen in that country. And for us to continue to have huge military operations with the deaths of many innocent civilians is not in the best interest of the United States.
And Ann, I certainly share your concern about particularly women in Afghanistan and what will happen were we to withdraw in, you know, some sort of short order. At the same time, the very presence of American troops there, the occupation itself, extends the credibility and the utility of these insurgent forces. And they give people a very clear choice. If you align with the United States, we will kill you sooner or later. And that kind of justice that they can extract, I think, makes it fundamentally impossible for us to occupy this country, pacify it in a way that would strengthen the central government to the point that they could take on these indigenous forces. And so I don't like to just walk away, particularly because we know how draconian these Islamic extremists will be, particularly with the rights of women. But we're causing the deaths of women and men by our very presence there. And these are things that are ultimately beyond our control, in my belief. And we're only putting more Americans at risk, wasting money, and also creating geopolitical turmoil that blows back on the United States in many unintended ways.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we've seen the history of what happens. And, you know, on the other side, people will say, well, we've seen the history when the U.S. backs off, and we've seen what happened in South Vietnam, that when the North Vietnamese came in, there were retribution killings. There were people that went into re-education camps. We saw in Somalia when the U.S. Removed itself and the rest of the NATO forces, or not NATO, but U.N. forces, that there was retribution from the Somali warlords. And it's true. And that's one of the just tragic things of getting involved militarily in these places, is that it's never thought out all the way down of what these U.S. interventions, invasions, and occupations will ultimately result in. And if you look at history, they've very seldom resulted in what the original intention was. If the American public was ever given the real goals of what the administrations had and going into these countries, supposedly the U.S. went into Afghanistan to go after Al Qaeda, and then, as you mentioned, you know, we never hear Al-Qaeda mentioned anymore.
Yeah.
And Al-Qaeda, the senior leadership, still sits in those tribal areas along the Afghan borders.
$25 million
on the heads of the senior leadership, yet nobody in those tribal areas is about to earn those $25 million, because they know that they'll probably not live to see to even get the money.
Right.
But there are plenty of people in the region that say, bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was right to take on the United States with some of the stuff it was doing. I don't agree with them, of course, but in terms of that type of violence, to get your point across, but the U.S., its decision to go into Afghanistan and yet not have clear objectives and go after those objectives, and then allow yourself to go into that war of choice on Iraq.
And let me interject here. To your knowledge, do we have a functional declaration of we don't declare war anymore, but some sort of authorization for the use of military force in Afghanistan? Because I thought what we authorized the administration to do, what the Congress did, was said that you could go after anybody who had a connection to 9/11. And that was the original premise for going into Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden and other leaders of Al-Qaeda. And to my knowledge, we have not amended that to really include propping up the Karzai government and trying to battle the Taliban. That never was part of the authorization that was issued, was it?
I don't believe it was. I think you're exactly right on it. And it was a part of this global war on terrorism that the Obama administration does not use anymore, that phrase, but it was an authorization essentially to go anywhere, anytime, to go after anyone an administration says has anything to do with jeopardizing U.S. national security. And as a result, you know, we now have the enemy combatants category, which you and I as American citizens can even fall under, and military commissions, and still just to move on to another aspect of this whole thing, still Guantanamo open with 250 people still in it, I believe, and the Obama administration saying there may be some people there that can never have trials, mean, I was stunned when I heard that, that indeed they are too dangerous so that the techniques used to used on them during their incarceration, they can never come forward in court and even talk about them. And that just struck me so hard when I heard that that's what the Obama administration was doing, because what we had certainly expected out of them was a real look at what is going on there and proper treatment for everyone, no matter what they ultimately may be accused or found guilty of doing. But it has to be in a legitimate legal proceedings. And yet we see a fallback from on the Obama administration's position on that.
Yeah. And, Colonel, I want to move to one other occupation flashpoint, and then I'll get to the main subject I wanted to talk to you about today. And that is the situation in Gaza. And it was very troubling to me that in the final days of the Bush administration, the corrupt Olmert administration in Israel launched a unilateral assault on Gaza that was simply unconscionable. And at the time, I was getting live reports from a man there who was risking his life. And I recall very, very clearly one conversation where he put his phone out the window and we could hear the Israeli tank that was rumbling past his house and shelling a building down the street. And they used our weapons. They used our cluster bombs. We resupplied them shortly after this incursion. And while President Obama made some references in his Cairo speech that were critical of the occupation, and while I do credit him with attempting to start a peace process very early in his administration between Israel and the Palestinians, the bottom line for me is that he has not really declared his opposition to the unilateral moves that Israel made, and they claim a provocation that clearly didn't exist. I support the Free Gaza movement, which has made many attempts now to send boats from Cyprus to Gaza to break the blockade and try to provide needed humanitarian aid to those who are trapped in this this huge prison camp. And I'd like to know your thoughts, and I know that you've been active over this past summer in helping Americans and other international peace workers gain access to Gaza. Take a couple of minutes to tell us about that.
Surely. Well, I have been to Gaza three times in the past year. We started Medea Benjamin of Code Pink Women for Peace, Tig Berry, Code Pink out of Los Angeles, and I went into Gaza in late January, just 10 days after the fighting had ended, or not fighting, the attack, the Israeli attack on Gaza ended. We went in because we wanted to see with our own eyes what had happened. We'd seen some of the photographs. You know, there weren't a lot of them out there because the Israelis would not let journalists in, only those that were already in Gaza when the attack started. But those pictures that we saw were horrific. And we went in January only for 24 hours. The Egyptians, when they let us in, we were some of the very few international people they were letting in. They said, "We're closing the border tomorrow. You can stay in for 24 hours, or we don't know when we'll reopen it." And it turned out it was 20 days later, the next time that border was open. Gaza has really been, it has just been smashed. 1,440 people killed, 5,000 wounded, 50,000 homeless. Virtually every government building destroyed. Foods and materials have to come in through a tunnel system under the Egyptian border because of the three-year international quarantine blockade, the open-air prison now of Gaza. And you mentioned the Free Gaza boat movement. I mean, what brave people they are to try to challenge the naval blockade of Gaza. And this last time in June, they tried their last attempt right after we came out of Gaza for actually the third time. We've been into Gaza three times. The second time was taking 60 people in for International Women's Day. The third time was 66 people going in to try to build playgrounds. And then three other groups that we helped organize that from people who had been on our earlier trip. Then another group that we took in actually to Israel to try to challenge from the Israeli side going to the Eretz border crossing to say these borders have to open, that you cannot continue this siege on Gaza, the collective punishment of 1.5 million people who live in a tiny area, 25 miles long and 5 miles wide on average. It's one of the most densely populated places in the world. And, of course, I don't condone Hamas or other militant groups sending the rockets into Israel. I mean, that is really not accomplishing anything other than massive, disproportionate responses by the largest military in the Middle East. On the other hand, you can say, well, what else can they do? I mean, they have no military, they have no air force, they have no tanks to the invasion, incursion by the Israelis, the occupation, reoccupation of Gaza for about 15 days out of the 22 days during that attack, where the tanks of the Israeli military just smashed huge portions of agricultural land, tearing up olive orchards that had been there for centuries, and agricultural produce. I mean, it was horrific what they did with those tanks, much less, of course, the loss of life caused by it.
Well, they also used bulldozers as a weapon, and they bulldozed olive trees that had recently been planted to try to provide sustenance and a potential export product for the people who were trapped there.
Yes, that's right. Well, we're organizing another event to go to Gaza. The event's not quite the right word, but it's a time for the international community to say again that this siege has to end. Let me just mention one other group. George Galloway, the British Member of Parliament, has organized two convoys to Gaza. The first one that went in March with over 100 vehicles and over 300 people who had driven all the way from the U.K., then a second one organized in the United States called Viva Palestina USA. And they took about 200 people and then purchased vehicles in Egypt and then drove them to the border hoping to get them in. And my understanding is that the Egyptians let about half of them in. Then now in December, we're organizing what we're calling the Gaza Freedom March. And you can go online, GazaFreedomMarch.org. And we're trying to get hundreds of international people all over the world to come to Egypt on the 26th of December and then to go to Gaza the 26th and be there for a march that we're going to take on January 1st to try to march to these borders to say you must open them. And we know, you know, the Israelis, if anybody marches to the borders, if they're Palestinians, they shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
We are saying, you know, this has got to end, and we, the people, when the governments of the world won't act, or they're acting in ways that I believe are criminally, they're doing criminal acts against collective punishment against the people of Gaza, for actually they're electing Hamas as the government of Gaza. That we, the people, are the ones that have to go forward and say this has to end. We're hoping lots and lots of people, hundreds, maybe thousands, mm-hmm. would join us. Because we cannot let the people of Gaza die,
yeah.
and die of silence and being ignored by the international community.
Well, and I think that Americans need to see that occupation itself is evil and untenable. And whether it's the occupation of Gaza, the occupation of Iraq, Afghanistan, these things are all, efforts that people can rationalize on a certain level, but fundamentally they cannot last, they cannot stand, because no population group will accept its subjugation by a larger military force over a long period of time. And, you know, that to me is the fundamental here that unites these disparate occupations. It just doesn't work. And it often leads to the destabilization of the occupiers themselves.
Well, you're right. And, you know, the number of Jewish writers who have been commenting on Israel's decision to mount such a disproportionate attack on Gaza, and also leading back to 2006 on that attack on Lebanon, there are many Jewish writers that are coming forward to say what the governments of Israel are doing right now is really jeopardizing Israeli national security,
mm-hmm.
and that there has to be a change. And, you know, it's hard for a lot of Jewish people in the United States and around the world to criticize the government of Israel, but Now we're finding more and more and more people of the Jewish faith that are coming forward to say that if we want Israel to survive, it can't go on doing this. And also that the complete silence and compliance by the U.S. government, not just the Bush administration, and certainly the Obama administration has not been as forward in their comments, and in also their aid. They've said there's $300 million available for reconstruction of Gaza, except they don't know who they can partner with, because, of course, Hamas is on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations, and they refuse to acknowledge that there are hundreds of other groups that are in Gaza that do international aid work all the time anyway. Despite the quarantine and the blockade, they are still doing work in Gaza, and there are certainly plenty of organizations that could administer help, because Gaza looks the same as it did when we went in there in January. There's been no rebuilding at all of the homes, the homes of 50,000 people that were destroyed. Nothing has been rebuilt. The hospitals that have been damaged, I mean, they're still standing there. Unrepaired. It is astounding that the international community ignores the human suffering that is going on in Gaza.
Yeah.
And you talk about women and children and men affected by military assaults, attacks, the level of post-traumatic stress disorder, the acting out, the tension, the strains in Gaza are horrific, and they need help, and yet we can't get help to them.
We're talking with Colonel Ann Wright here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And, Colonel, the actual reason why I asked you on the show today is some work that you have been dedicated to over the last few years, trying to help women in the military who have been the victims of violence, including sexual assault. And I want to note that you spent 13 years on active duty in the Army and another 16 years in the Reserve. So you have a long history of military service as a female. And I'd like to know if you found that during your service, active and reserve, that you were treated respectfully. But when women were recruited for, combat-related duties that we have seen in particular in Iraq, that the standards have dropped sharply, and the reports of sexual violence in particular against our women in uniform have gone up sharply, and it's a very alarming situation.
Indeed it is. During the time that I was in the military, I certainly knew that there were isolated incidents of sexual assault and rape. I never dreamed that there were as many as we're now finding out about. And it's only because the Veterans Administration actually is starting to track as women come forward to be treated at Veterans Administration's hospitals and clinics. On their questionnaire, they ask, have you ever been sexually assaulted or raped? And they ask it not only of women, but of men, too. And that's where we're getting the figures that of the women presenting themselves to the VA, it seems like one in three of them sexually assaulted.
I want to ask you to repeat that, because there was a little breakup in the phone there. One in three women are reporting sexual assault as they served our country in Iraq?
Not in Iraq, but as the ones who have come to the veterans' hospitals are reporting it, one in three.
Wow.
We don't have the full picture yet of what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have the numbers of reported rapes. Rape in the military, as in civilian life, is the most underreported crime that there is. And of the rapes just for the Army in 2007, I believe that's the last set of figures, there were 2,800 women that reported, or 2,800 persons that reported being raped.
Mm-hmm.
And at a congressional hearing, when the Deputy Chief of Staff of Personnel for the Army was asked, do guys ever get raped? And he said, after a long silence, well, 10% of those who reported being raped in 2007 were men who reported. So that's 280 men that had reported being raped.
Wow.
We don't know the full extent, because a lot of women do not report it because it gets them It gets them in even deeper problems.
Right.
That they're, sometimes it's their chain of command, people that men who are in their leadership positions in their units who have committed these criminal acts on them. The majority of women that I'm talking to said they've never reported it because they knew it was just going to be too big of a problem, and yet now they're finally starting to get emotional counseling for what happened to them. So we're starting a campaign through Veterans for Peace. It's going to be a week of awareness, sexual assault and rape awareness, and in fact, it's going to be in October, and on October 13th, on Tuesday the 13th, we're going to be at Times Square in New York City, where there's a Army recruiting office right there in the middle of Times Square, and we're going to take stickers, and we've got statistics up there. 1 in 3 women reported being raped. It should be a warning that should be on every recruiting office. Every young woman ought to know that there are dangers lurking within the military. So we're going to go there, and we're going to plaster that recruiting office with those signs, because if the military won't warn the women, we, the citizens, are going to warn them.
And you and some colleagues at Cal State University San Marcos, which I believe is near San Diego, have developed a new website, and I think this is a very important resource for women in the military. I think it's a very important place for people who aren't aware of the depth of this problem to get detailed information. And it's U.S. Military Violence Against Women, so usmvaw.com. Now, I'll post this at peterbcollins.com in the notes to this podcast, but I'll read it again. It's usmvaw.com, and that stands for U.S. Military Violence Against Women.com. And I think what I'd like to do, Ann, is arrange to do a future program with you and some of the women, and there are some men, to be fair, who are working on this website and this project, because I think it's very significant, and I think that this is an issue that is underreported, that is deeply buried, and that we need to empower women who are serving in the military to protect themselves, and we have to create an environment where they can come forward and find justice for this kind of criminal behavior that happens under the color of a military uniform.
Well, we would certainly appreciate your help on this, and I might also add that, you know, it's not just U.S. military women that are suffering the effects. Women that are in other countries where there are U.S. military bases, particularly in Japan and Okinawa, there have been a lot of women that have been raped by U.S. military. In fact, I just came back from a 3-week speaking tour in Japan and met with two women who had been sexually assaulted by U.S. military in Japan, and trying to get the Japanese legal system, the U.S. military courts-martial system to get them mobilized to acknowledge these criminal acts has been very difficult for these women.
Yeah. Well, Ann, I want to thank you for your time today. Thanks for all the effort that you put into these various issues that we've discussed. And I want you to know that you inspire me.
Well, you're most kind. And thank you, Peter B. Collins, for having such a wonderful resource for all of us, for all the issues that we're so concerned about. Thank
all right.
you.
Colonel Ann Wright, we'll talk again soon. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
That's the late, great Tennessee Ernie Ford, and one of the original anti-corporate anthems. It's called 16 Tons, I Owe My Soul to the Company Store. In a recent podcast, we talked about corporations and what's called corporate personhood with David Cobb, the former Green Party presidential candidate. He is a party, a plaintiff, a friend of the court plaintiff to the Supreme Court case that is going to be heard in September regarding the Hillary Clinton documentary that was is the subject of this case that involves the McCain-Feingold law. And in response to that, I got an email from longtime listener Andy Drawl. He works as an analyst on Wall Street, and he joins us from very close to there right now. In the interest of protecting the guilty, we won't name where he works. Andy, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Peter.
So you wrote me an email and shared a copy of a letter that you sent to the chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and you have an interesting idea which would shift the balance of power in corporate America. Tell us what's on your mind.
Well, it's not actually my idea. It's actually a ruling. It's a 250-page document that the SEC has come up with, and they were asking for a request for comment. I think it was posted on their website in late June, and they've actually extended the comment period. But the ruling is for proxy access and making it easier for shareholders to put up their own nominees as boards, as a director on the board.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is a very important area of corporate governance. And as I explained in the previous podcast with David Cobb, I actually believe that the corporate form and the legal structure of it is brilliant, and that if it is permitted to work as intended, that it would protect the interests of shareholders in a way that we don't see as common today. And to me, the glue is the so-called fiduciary obligation that a board member has to honor the interests of the shareholders above all others. And what we've seen in recent years is an erosion of that relationship, as the directors are much more beholden to the management of the company, and in particular to the CEO, than they are to the shareholders themselves. What do you see as the state of shareholder rights in this country, and how would this shift in the proxy access change that in your view, Andy?
Well, some people claim it'll be a fundamental realtering of corporate governance. It'll be one of the biggest corporate governance reforms ever proposed by the SEC. Although this form of voting to allow shareholders actually to put up nominees has been done in Australia and it's been done in the UK, United Kingdom, for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the more Germanic-oriented countries, like Germany and France and Eastern Europe, a board of directors usually has a representative from the union or from workers on the board, a certain percentage. But even in the UK and Australia where this is done, it's very rare that the shareholders will actually put together a opposing slate of directors, because it is an enormous task to try to take out the people in management. You know, think about with Carl Icahn, with Jerry Yang over at Yahoo,
mm-hmm.
trying to take out the board with all the money he has to throw at a proxy fight. It was very difficult for him to even get on the board. So still, I think it's pretty difficult to do, but at least it'll get accountability back. It can put a little threat and a little fear in the hearts of these directors and maybe push them to actually take into consideration the long-term effects of what management's doing, and in particular, corporate pay and salaries that are out of sight.
Right.
And I think we need this accountability. And the SEC rule is pretty watered down. You're only, according to the ruling the way it is now, you're only allowed to replace 25% of the directors. So the normal board is maybe a dozen directors, so you can only replace three of them anyway.
Right.
Under the proposed ruling.
Now, isn't that based on corporate charters, though? Don't the bylaws of the corporation establish that, you know, you elect the board in shifts, not all at once? And that makes sense in terms of continuity. But when you have a failed board, it strikes me that there needs to be some sort of an exception that permits the shareholders to act that decisively in order to save their money and save the corporation.
Commerce is going to do is they're going to fight this in court, just like David Cobb is going to court again with that Hillary movie situation.
Mm-hmm.
The Chamber of Commerce believes that the state of Delaware really sets the rules for how proxy voting is supposed to be, and this is a state's rights law, not actually the charter, but they believe the states set the corporate rules of how this is going to be done. So that's what the Chamber of Commerce is going to do. The Chamber of Commerce has never really recognized the SEC as a body that had power to regulate. But no question, if you have the ability to get other board members on there, I mean, this has to have a positive effect. And right now, according to the way the states and the state of Delaware, which is where most corporations are actually registered,
right,
is set up, it's up to management whether they want to let other the shareholders, but board members on or up for nomination. Mm-hmm. And there was a study done by FactSet, Shark Watch, it's called, and out of 4,000 companies, they only found five that actually let a proxy vote for outside directors. So right now, it's left up to management. The state of Delaware says, well, management can decide. And the charter, too, is set up by management. It's done by a vote, and but management sets up what the charter, corporate charter is going to be. So everything is all totally tied up in an autocratic, non-democratic system run by management.
Yeah.
It's basically, you know, a corporate dictatorship, and that's got to change if you want any kind of corporate governance and positive benefits to shareholders.
Let me read a paragraph here from your letter, Andy, because I think it'll help people understand a little more. You write, "The proxy access rule, the rights of shareholders to nominate directors, is long overdue. Shareholders need a means to take ownership of the corporate board because shareholders are the owners, the rightful owners. The board must work for shareholders. Under the current system, it doesn't. Shareholders are not dissidents. They're the owners. So the company must avail themselves to provide the ease, funding, and assistance so an opposing board gets a fair evaluation before the proxy vote. Mailing fees should be paid for by the company because the owners have every right to make this request. Management has to work for the shareholders. The only way that's going to happen is when the shareholders have more say over the selection of the board members." And so I think you make a number of important points there, and at the risk of excessive repetition, I think it's really very important to understand that management in most cases does not own controlling interest in the company they manage. And therefore, your point about the shareholders not being dissidents, but in fact they're the rightful owners, is just right on.
Correct. The board is supposed to be there to oversee management and make sure management acts in the best interest of shareholders. And now that is not occurring. Also, I noticed one of the commenters to this, his name is Lucius Bebchuk. He's a professor at Harvard University.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote one of the request for comment letters on the SEC site that's signed by 80 professors from 47 different universities around this country. They're economics professors, business law professors, other finance-type professors, and all of them are for making easier proxy access. And the main problem is the management of the board, or the management of these companies control the access to the proxy process. They know who all the shareholders are. They know how to get access to the shareholders. They have the money, because it can cost millions of dollars to run an opposing proxy campaign. So just getting that access and opening up that process and putting a few directors on the same ballot that management sends out to shareholders would be an enormous progress in corporate governance.
Mm-hmm. So comments are being sought right now. If people go to the SEC website, Andy, can they deliver comments just like you did?
Yes.
Okay.
You can just write a letter and upload it to the site. I'm not sure how much longer the comment period goes. Matter of fact, it was extended. It ended on August 17th, but I think it was extended another 30 or 60 days.
Okay.
I'm not sure how much.
Mm-hmm.
But as of right now, I know you can still do it.
All right. And Andy, just being objective here, can you think of any unintended consequences that might create an opportunity for somebody to strong arm a board and take over a company?
Well, that's one of the opposing arguments against it, that a hedge fund could come in and take over the board and try to sell the company and do some things that wouldn't be in the best interest of shareholders. Other companies, management and the Chamber of Commerce are worried about groups like PETA or Amnesty International or some other special interest pressure on management to do something for their interests and getting a board member on there that would just cause kind of upheaval on the board. I'm not sure. It depends where you are politically or how you feel about some of these issues. But
well, I think the example of Human Rights Watch or PETA or the other organizations, that's pretty much a red herring, because it would take a lot for them to collect enough shareholder votes or to aggregate enough shares to actually produce more than the proxy fight itself. I'd be more concerned that a company that is doing a good job, that is a good steward and takes good care of its employees, might be raided by somebody who guts the union contracts, cuts employee benefits, breaks up the profitable parts of the company and sells them off as a bottom feeder like, say, Sam Zell might do.
Right, or a Carl Icahn, among others. True.
Mm-hmm. So can you envision some protections that might give what we're looking for, which is improved corporate governance and responsiveness by the board to shareholders without creating a huge vulnerability that, again, an unintended consequence might take a decent company and turn it into a breakup target or a takeover target by predators?
Well, historically, what companies have done is they've had poison pills or they've had it's called green mail, where they have different clauses in when a certain amount of shares are bought up by a hostile bidder. These clauses kick in, and it makes it unpalatable for the takeover to take place. Of course, that would hold for something, somebody good you'd want that to happen with, too, when they get a certain number of shares.
Yeah.
If they keep the hurdle low as far as the number of shares you need to appoint a board member, then it wouldn't be enough shares to necessarily take over, because you're under the ruling now, it's only 25% of the board,
mm-hmm.
which isn't enough to take the board over, take the company over. You'd need much more than that
mm-hmm.
to get more control, and you'd have more voting shares. So usually when somebody does a takeover, it's more than 1%. The way the rule works is for very large companies over $700 million in market cap, you only need 1% of the shares. If it's between $75 million, I think it's $700 million, you need 3%. And then if it's under $75 million, you need 5% of the shares.
Mm-hmm.
But those are still very low share amounts to take over and have a lot of the voting power
right.
on the board. So you're keeping it a much lower number. To pull a Sam Zell, you'd probably need over 25% of the shares, a much bigger amount. And then
mm-hmm.
if you had poison pills or green mail or the usual, which are really not very good for shareholders either, because it more benefits management when these
right. yeah.
different tactics kick in. The only other way is shareholders just have to be smart when those proxy votes come in to do their due diligence and make sure they make the proper votes
mm-hmm.
and know that management will fight tooth and nail to try to let shareholders know that there is a possibility that it is a hedge fund, it is a hostile takeover, and not to place that vote. I mean, you just have to hope you have smart shareholders that are intelligent enough
mm-hmm.
to make the proper vote.
Yeah. Now, Andy, how can I put this? The kind of the last line of defense against total management dominance of corporations is some of the pension fund managers of public pensions like CalPERS and some of the other state retirement funds. Do you see a way that they could use this kind of proxy access for a good purpose, which is to hold the directors accountable, to make sure that shareholders get appropriate value and that shareholders have an adequate role in the governance of the company?
Well, I know for sure CalSTRS, the California State Teachers Fund, is a big proponent of proxy access. So is the State of Ohio Pension Fund and the Colorado State Pension Fund have written letters to the SEC backing and are proponents of the proxy access. So, yes, of course, most of the state pension funds that represent the interests of the union workers for those states want more egalitarian corporate governance, and that means not overpaying executives, you know, not spending money wildly,
mm-hmm.
not doing things with corporate money that's going to take management off the track of its particular strategy, and doing things that are particularly risky, and maybe having good risk management in place and good enterprise risk management systems, and not doing perverse hedging or different type of derivative contracts, or doing things that might be way out there. Certainly, they would have control over the at least a portion of the board to be able to flag things like that before they get out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
You would hope.
Yeah.
Because one thing I do say in my letter, you know, you've had these things like Enron and WorldCom, and there are accounting irregularities. There's the Nigerian barge deal with Enron. There's the huge leverage situation at Bear Stearns, where it used to be 4 or 5 to 1 leverage to equity, and the SEC let it go to over 15 to 1, and then they just went and made it limitless to 30 to 1. Maybe if you had some board members, you could stop that from happening.
Yeah.
And stop a meltdown before it occurs.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andy, one other thing I want to ask you about, it's not directly related, but what percentage of publicly traded corporations actually pay dividends today? Because that's another area where they've really given short shrift to shareholders.
Gee whiz, I do not know what the answer to that is. But there had been a move where it was becoming more popular to give dividends than it was in the past, because companies had stopped growing, and particularly of the owners of the company that were inside the company themselves, who held a lot of shares, could see that they weren't getting the benefit of capital gains and appreciation, so they began giving more dividends now, and that's a recent transition. When you don't have the capital gains, when you don't have the growth in the stock market, you start giving dividends again. So a lot of companies did start giving more dividends, but unfortunately, with the downward spiral in the stock market and a lot of companies having financial problems, they cut a lot of the dividends.
Well, but they don't cut corporate cut executive compensation or stock options. And it becomes much more of a casino play, where instead of a little guy like me buying and holding and enjoying a 3 or 5% dividend each year, I have to make my money by buying and selling. And that creates a lot of volatility in the market, where if we had a larger percentage of companies paying dividends, I think the average shareholder would be more likely to buy and hold and enjoy that trickle of income.
Well, that's true. Certainly, there are some companies that are not growing, do not know what to do with the money, would be better off giving it to shareholders. Other companies have a lot of projects they can invest in, that their hurdle rate they have for a project might give them a large return, so it would be better for them to invest in the company, and it'll come out in capital gains anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on the particular entity.
Yeah.
Another thing, a lot of times what we look at, if we look at how much ownership the executives of the company have, because a lot of times executives are out for their own interests, and if they have millions of shares, they want to give themselves dividends,
mm-hmm.
and they will.
Mm-hmm.
And they will up the dividend, even when the dividend probably shouldn't be raised.
Yeah.
Is what we see.
Very interesting. Well, Andy, I want to thank you for your activism. You've always been a great contributor to the Peter B. Collins Show, and you keep me posted on any developments regarding the proxy access rule and the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yeah, in early November, they're supposed to have a vote on it, and there's 2 Democrats and 2 Republicans, and you can guess which way both of those will go, and then Mary Shapiro makes a deciding vote.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and if people want to make that comment, there still may be time to do so. Drop by the SEC website and check it out. Andy, thanks for joining us live from noisy Wall Street today.
All right, Peter. Have a nice day.
Yeah, good to talk to you again. Yep, very live. And sorry for the noise there, but he was at an actual rare payphone in New York City. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.